In yesterday's Parsha, we read about the mitzvah of Shemitah. And that's going to be very, very relevant because the coming year is a Shemitah year in the land of Israel. And Shemitah basically means that farmers are not supposed to farm the land. They don't plant. They don't plow. Now, the Rabbanut does have a heter. They sell all the land to a guy symbolically like the chametz, and they allow the land to be cultivated that way. The more right-wing religious community does not accept that concept and the like, and that's a big, big machlokas. Maybe we'll devote a share to that eventually. But I just want to focus on one idea. The Torah says, if you will say, what shall we eat on the sixth year if we're not allowed to plant and we're not allowed to harvest? So God says, I will give you a blessing on the sixth year, that you will have such an abundance of crops that it will carry you to the sixth year and the seventh year and even into the eighth year until you get your new crops. So the Sopurna, who's one of the classical medieval commentators, asks a very interesting question. Are you only going to get a bracha if you complain? If you complain, I'll give you a bracha. Well, what if I don't complain? What if I accept what? So I'm going to be worse off? So the Sopurna says a beautiful, beautiful thought. He lived in the 1500s, so it's way before Hasidus, but it is a Hasidic-type thought. He said that the real bracha in life is not the quantity Hashem gives you. The real bracha in life is the inner joy and happiness you get, even if Hashem gives you very little. So optimally, if you truly have faith in Hashem, you're not going to need a lot to give you confidence. You will have confidence and serenity even in the little. But Nebuch, if you're a complainer, if you don't feel Hashem is taking care of you, so Hashem says, I got to throw more stuff at you. So in reality, the notion of a bracha by a riboy, by an increase in kamus, in quantity, is much, much inferior to the bracha that one gets by appreciating what Hashem has given him. And of course, what do our sages say in Pirkei Avos? I'm sure you know this statement. Ezeu Asher, right? Who is the wealthy person? Hasameach b'chelko, he who is happy with what Hashem has given him. So just as it's a beautiful thought, I think, both for Shemitah and for life generally. You know, we all know this. A person could have so much and be miserable, and a person can have very little and have a great, great inner joy. And if you had to choose between the two, the inner joy of and not having a lot is just a better life than the turbulence and anxiety, even if you have so many things. Yeah, I'm saying.
I don't get how there's a heter to sell it to a goy, because there's like no, the whole, it seems like it defeats the purpose, kind of.
Well, that's a very strong argument, meaning to say you're selling it to a goy because otherwise people are going to be starving. Well, what does that mean? The Torah says God's going to give you a bracha. Are you questioning Hashem's bracha? Yeah, it is a very good question, but it's a complicated question. We'll need a whole share in this. The basic idea is that according to many, many authorities, the Shemitah that is observed today is a rabbinic obligation, not a Torah obligation. And consequently, in a rabbinic obligation, we have certain leniencies that we would never be allowed to do if Shemitah would be a Torah law. So as a result, it only applies when Shemitah is rabbinic. And then you'd have to have a whole discussion, well, what makes Shemitah rabbinic and not Torah? And again, it's connected to the idea that only when all of the Jews are living in Israel does it become a Torah commandment, and today it would not be. That's kind of the argument. Okay, but as I say, most of the, I can't say numerically, but most of what we would regard as Charedim and Hasidim, both non-Hasidic, ultra-Orthodox, I hate that word, and Hasidim do not accept the validity of the sale. But the group that does would be what we call the Dati Leumi. Many religious Zionists do accept that concept. Okay. All right. So now let's go to our main topic for tonight. And again, switching gears quite radically, so to speak. But again, people were interested in reproductive options, and of course, let me just say that all reproductive options should not be exercised until marriage. That is to be understood. I'll talk about that. There'd be some interesting questions about that as well. We start off, of course, with the very first mitzvah in the Torah, and the very first mitzvah in the Torah is to be fruitful and multiply. This is what God said to Adam and Chava in Gan Eden. to be fruitful and multiply, to try to, I can't say to have children, because that's up to God, but to try, right, to try to have children. And we even have a halachic definition of how many kids is the minimum, not the maximum, of course. The minimum is one does not fulfill the mitzvah of procreation until they have a son and a daughter, one boy and one girl. So if you have 100 boys, got to keep on going.
How do we derive that?
Well, we derive it because, as he says, and God blessed them, meaning Adam and Eve, you shall be fruitful and multiply, meaning you should replicate yourselves, the male and the female. 100 boys, got to keep trying. 100 girls, got to keep trying, etc. Once in a while, somebody has twins, a boy and girl twin, so they've done the mitzvah right away. But until you have the boy and the girl, you have not done the mitzvah. Now, what if you have the boy and the girl? Do you have to keep going? So here, what's interesting is this. There are different levels. I don't want to go into all the technicalities because I do want to talk about the high-tech issues. But the basic idea is this. The Torah commandment of fruitful and multiply is when you've replicated yourself, meaning to say a boy, you know, a man and a woman have produced a boy and a girl. However, in the words of the prophets, the Navi Yeshayahu, Isaiah, there is another verse that says, Lo tohu bera'ah. That means Hashem did not create the world to be desolate. La sheves yitzara. He created the world to be inhabited. And this is taken by our sages to mean that even after you've done the minimum of son and daughter, there is actually a mitzvah to have as many children as you're able to have. But here is the thing to keep in mind. Since this extra directive, La Sheves, is not a Torah commandment, it is from the prophets, it is not quite as strict. So you'll find in Halacha, again, I'm not giving a share on contraception tonight, but I just want to point out, you will find if you ever have to discuss with a posek an issue of contraception or birth control, you will often find a sharp distinction between a couple that has not yet had a son and a daughter and a couple that has had a son and a daughter, because the concept is, even though there are heterim even before that point, but the heterim are much more prevalent after that point, because once you've fulfilled the Torah commandment and you're simply dealing with the prophetic injunction, there is more leniency on that level than there is on the Torah command. So one of the questions that a posek is always going to discuss with you is, do you already have the boy-girl situation? After that point, one still is supposed to try to have, as you obviously know from living in Yerushalayim, there is a mitzvah to try to have large families. But again, as I say, contraception does exist within halacha. There are grounds for leniencies. We can leave it for another time, what those leniences are, but they don't have to be, the mother will die otherwise. You don't need pikuach nefesh. Now, there's things short of pikuach nefesh.
What was
might
the,
justify. Yeah.
The
verse? Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is in Yeshayahu, which is Isaiah, one of the great prophets, and it's it says in Hebrew, it's Lo tohu bera'ah. La Sheves Yitzara. Again, it's a bit of an obscure pasuk. It's not such a well-known pasuk. But it basically means God did not create the world to be empty. He created the world to be inhabited. And this is taken by our sages to mean that even after the minimum, one should try to keep going, unless there's a heter. Again, I do want you to understand there are concepts of heterim here, but you need a heter, meaning to say it can't just be something, oh, I don't feel like having more kids right now, it's too much of a bother. There has to be something a little bit more than that that situation. Yeah.
Is having children man's mitzvah as well as a woman's?
Okay, so now I'm going to talk about this. Actually, now there's something very strange about Peru Revu that's going to sound almost nonsensical. That is, the mitzvah of having children is only on the man. It is not on the woman. There's a mitzvah on men to have children. Now, you might say, well, wait a second here. It's the women that have the children. So here is the concept, and I'll explain why and how we know. Number one, how do we know this? Number two, what's the reason for it? And that is, there's a mitzvah on a man to find a spouse who is willing to have children with him. A man has a mitzvah to procreate. A woman actually is not commanded to procreate. Now, obviously, if a woman marries a man who's commanded, she becomes obligated just because he's commanded, so they have to work together on this. But technically, the chiyuv of having a child is on a man and not on a woman. Now, how do we know this? We know this because when the Torah says to Adam and Chava, "Pru urvu, be fruitful and multiply, umilu es haaretz, and fill the earth, v'kifshuha, and conquer it." The word that's used is conquer it. So the Talmud says, well, conquest sounds like war. Actually, sometimes parenting does resemble a war, you know, a war with your kids. But conquer. So conquer implies something like a military activity, and since that's associated with men and not women, so the procreation is connected to conquest, and therefore men are chayav, men are obligated, women are exempt. That's the derivation. But what's the logic of it? So I'll tell you an interesting reason that is given. Again, we don't always know the reasons for mitzvos, and we can't say we know for sure. So you understand. I hope you've gathered through your learning in my note and other learning that Hashem's mitzvos are infinitely deep and infinitely wise. And even when we can give some reasons for them, they are only part of the reason. Maybe they're not even right. And even if they're right, they're only part of infinite reasons. But one of the reasons that is given is the following. Pregnancy and childbirth are actually potentially life-threatening conditions. I don't want to scare anybody, but, you know, women can die, even in a developed country. Baruch Hashem, it's gone down a lot. A woman can die during childbirth. Obviously, if she goes into labor, we desecrate the Shabbos. I shouldn't even call it desecrate. You know, we drive and we do whatever we need to do, etc. And pregnancy itself can have complications. So here is the thing. Even though Baruch Hashem, the vast, vast majority of women may have discomfort and it's not dangerous to them, but there is some potential of danger. So the Torah is not going to obligate a woman to do something that is dangerous for her. The Torah can tell a man, find a woman who is willing to do that. And that's the man's obligation. But the Torah is not going to tell the woman, you have to get pregnant, because that would essentially tell the woman, you have to do something that might be dangerous for you. Okay, so that's kind of the logic. Another reason that's given almost proceeds in the opposite way. And the opposite idea is that sometimes Hashem gives mitzvos only to those who wouldn't do it otherwise. And we say that women, as a general rule, have a stronger maternal urge, maybe because of a biological clock or whatever it is, than men. So the Torah doesn't have to tell women to have children, because that is a normal desire. With men, especially since a man doesn't have the biological clock, right? Strom Thurmond, was a senator in the United States who was still, you know, I think he married a few times, and he had his last child when he was 95 or something, etc. So the truth of the matter is, even with the Avos, the miracle of the Avos is always that the woman gave birth at an old age. The fact that Abraham had a child at an old age is not such a miracle, because in point of fact, even today, even very old people, old men can give birth. So a man could think to himself, oh, I got all the time in the world. You know, when I'm 95, I'll get married to a 25-year-old and have a child, etc. So God says to the man, you got to do a mitzvah as soon as you can. A woman, it's less necessary. But be it as it may, the concept basically is that halacha does differentiate between a man's obligation and a woman's obligation. Okay. Normally, the way one has a child is one gets married and, you know, one has a child. You know, that's how you hope it's going to work. But unfortunately, sometimes things don't work that way. Now, infertility throughout the world, especially in developed countries, has risen in recent years. Maybe it's connected to environmental pollutants. You know, who knows exactly why. But both male and female infertility. And this is often very, very sad for any couple, but for religious Jews, there's an extra level of sadness because there's a great mitzvah and a person very much wants to have children. And especially when you combine that with the Holocaust and trying to replenish the Jewish people, which is still something. In fact, it's interesting that, I'll tell you two things about this. Somebody was once walking in Yerushalayim with his very large family. He was taking them out somewhere. I guess the wife was at home. And there was a German woman, it sounds like a caricature story, but there was a German woman who did not really like the fact that she sees 20 children, you know, kind of running around and they're making noise and it offends her sense of order. So she says to him, you know, isn't this enough already? So he says, he looked at her and he said, when I get to 6 million, I'll stop counting. You know, okay, that's one remark. The other remark is a little more lighthearted. And that is, a woman was schlepping her 15 children onto a bus, and she was really, really exhausted. It's quite difficult. And she finally gets to 15 children on the bus, and she says, wow, this is really, really, I'm really, really tired. And the bus driver said, why didn't you leave some of them at home? She said, I did. Okay. So, yeah, all right. So, Baruch Hashem. Okay. But, you know, the people who have large families, again, I do want to say contraception does have a place in halakha, although that's not what I'm going to talk about tonight. But the truth of the matter is, when a person looks back at their life and they see all the children they were zocha to have, and then they wonder, should I have been on contraception? So the question always is, okay, which one of these would you like to give up? You know, after the fact, it's a whole different calculation. Because you see the preciousness of what it was that that you were able to create.
Point at which you're supposed to stop.
Well, again, I don't want to talk about contraception right now. There's no such thing as an automatic point. You can have 100, 200, 300, 500. That's not the point. The point is, you have to stop when you are no longer, you know, the woman in particular, is no longer able to function as a caring, loving, giving mother.
Well, there's that family,
and or there is danger to her health, or whatever it is. So it's not a question of stopping with the numbers. There are mothers who can handle gigantic families, and there are others who can get overwhelmed with one child, right? So every person has to, you know, evaluate themselves.
There's a family on TV that the Duggars that has 20 kids. Well, that had 20 kids.
Right, but they're
and
a happy family, right? He just died. Did he just die?
No.
Somebody. There was some case
girl.
Where
she was like very, very premature because like her body couldn't handle carrying the baby long enough, and the baby was so sick for so long. It's like it's not.
Listen. As I say, I mean. We consider children to be a bracha, but there are times in which it might be a bracha that's beyond a person's ability to carry. So one has to talk doctor, rav, you know, they have to work in collaboration. And the ikkar is that the woman's health should be preserved. Again, I do want to... And the children to be adequately taken care of. I do want to point out one thing. Again, I really don't want to talk about contraception tonight, but I do want to point out that do not confuse the halachic standards of contraception with the halachic standards of abortion. They are absolutely very, 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 very different. When we are talking about abortion, then really you need a threat to the mother's life, you know, that the mother is going to die. When we're talking about contraception, we don't need it to be that strict. We can look at psychological factors. We can look at other things that we would not, that in abortion wouldn't be enough, right? So one has to very, very clearly differentiate. That, in other words, to put it very bluntly, it is much easier to get a psak about birth control than it is to get a psak for abortion. Abortion is a very strict, even there are heterim, but they have to be pikuach nefesh type of heterim. Yeah.
Is there, like, any kind of precedent to get a heter if you think that you can't, like, financially support another child?
It would be very difficult to have such a heter, and it would have to be understood in different ways, meaning to say, lack of finances itself is not a heter. But you see, in life, things shade into each other, meaning to say, if lack of finances causes unbearable psychological stress that could lead to mental breakdown and abandonment...
Or like you can't buy enough food for your kids.
Okay, so that would be a situation. But again, it would be a shameful thing. I mean, let's assume like this. Let's assume that a poor person theoretically could get charity funds from Stucca, but they're too proud to do so. So we wouldn't say, oh, well, if you don't have food, you know, go ahead and have contraception. We would say in such a situation, the Jewish community has an obligation to help you and you have an obligation to go to them. But if the stresses of doing so are so unbearable that you have severe anxiety, so it's not the lack of economic resources, it's the anxiety. Right? So everything depends on the psychological and physical state, not the external circumstances. Okay, so that's an important thing. But again, tonight we're talking about not how to avoid having children, we're talking about how to have children. And if there is infertility, what does a person do? So Baruch Hashem, one of the great amazing areas of medicine that has expanded over the past 30 years, 40 years already, is we have what are called assisted reproductive technologies. And that's often abbreviated ARTs, assisted reproductive technologies, which are the utilization of science in order to enhance reproductive capacity when it doesn't happen in the normal way. Now, one thing about art that I should say at the outset, halacha does not require that a couple use it, meaning to say halacha requires only that they get married and they try to fulfill pru or vu the old-fashioned way. Halacha does not require, you know, IVF. It does not require artificial insemination. If the parties want to do it, they are permitted to do it. And of course, if they do it and they get a child, they have a mitzvah, but it is not an obligation. So now, on the other hand, virtually every religious couple will utilize these procedures, and to do so in Israel is actually a little better than in Chutz Laaretz, because these procedures are sometimes expensive, and often health insurance in the United States either does not cover it or may only cover it once or twice, and sometimes you need more efforts. In Israel, because Israel is a child-friendly country, Baruch Hashem, a Jewish state. So any kupat cholim, really, any of the medical services here, any of the medical insurance, will cover as many procedures as somebody wants to do.
Even if you're not religious?
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, absolutely. Kupat cholim has nothing to do with religion. I'm saying Israel is a child-friendly country, whether you're religious or secular. And therefore, if one does have infertility, well, there are two reasons why Israel is a good country to be into. Number one, because the medical procedures are covered by insurance. But number two, there is a special sechus to be in Eretz Israel. That, in fact, we are saying living in Eretz Israel itself is a segula, is divine bracha for having children. That's why there's a halacha in the Shulchan Aruch that we don't keep today. But there is a halacha in the Shulchan Aruch that if a man was married to a woman for 10 years and they didn't have children, so the Shulchan Aruch says the man should divorce, and let's say he knows it's not his physical problem, that he's able to, let's say. So the man should divorce the woman in order to marry somebody that can have children. Now again, we actually do not follow that halacha today, but that was the original halacha. But it's brought down.
It,
yeah. Say again?
Some
people follow it, but generally speaking, the Rama says we discourage that.
What
but because it basically says that Bizman Hazeh, the idea is that it's harder to find a spouse. In other words, in the olden days, people kind of like married anybody and they made it work. But today we live in a day and age where people need more of a emotional connection, so to speak, and therefore husbands and wives are not interchangeable in that same way. So you can't simply say, oh, get rid of it and marry somebody else. You know, it doesn't work that way. But I want to point out that let's say husband and wife were married for 5 years and then they moved to Israel. The clock starts over again, meaning to say you got to have 10 years in Israel before this applies, because maybe the merit of Eretz Yisrael will give them the bracha of children. We get that from Avram. That's exactly right. Because Avram, of course, didn't divorce Sarah. Avram did something else. Avram took a concubine. But it says he took a concubine, Hagar, only after he was 10 years in the land of Israel. Even though they were married much more than 10 years, right? So you actually have that proof that you have to give yourself 10 years in Israel before you consider yourself infertile and then invoke these remedies.
Did you say it's a mitzvah for a divorce, or you just can't?
No, no. In the Shulchan Aruch, it actually is a mitzvah to do it. But the Rama says we do not follow this, or at least we do not encourage it, bizmanazah, you know, and the like. Okay, so what are the options for a couple that cannot have a child? So let's first talk about a very low-tech option, which also costs a lot of money. And that is, what about adopting a child? Well, we can't have a child of our own. We want to adopt. Well, the thing about adoption is this. There is a mitzvah to take an orphan who doesn't have parents who can raise the child and raise the child as your own. But then the question becomes, if you adopt a child, do you fulfill the mitzvah of being fruitful and multiply? So 99% of the poskim say you do not fulfill procreation. I mean, you might be doing a wonderful thing. It's a wonderful, wonderful thing to give a child, especially a special needs child, but even a child that's not special needs, to give them a home and an environment. But for pru or vu purposes, it doesn't work simply because it is not your biological child. But okay. But let's say they still want a child, right? They want to have a child, right? So they adopt. Should the child be Jewish or not Jewish? So here, it's a very strange situation. There is certainly a greater chesed, a greater mitzvah, to adopt a Jewish child. There's no question. But halachically, adopting a Jewish child has certain complications. That doesn't mean it's not a great mitzvah to give a Jewish child a home. It is a great, great mitzvah. But it does raise halachic problems, and that is the following. If you don't know who the parents of the Jewish child were, then possibly, the Jewish child was conceived by adultery. In other words, a married woman may have had an affair, or the Jewish child was conceived, God forbid, even by incest. Now, a child that is conceived by adultery or incest is the mamzer child. Now, a mamzer is a Jew. That doesn't mean there's no mitzvah to take care of him, but it does mean that, unfortunately, the child may have a halachic problem in who he can marry later.
I have heard that according to Halacha, a child of a non-Jewish father cannot be considered as a mamzer.
That is actually correct. That is correct. In order to be a mamzer, a Jewish man had to have illicit relations with a Jewish woman who was halachically married to a Jewish man. So a Jewish man who commits adultery with a halachically married Jewish woman who's married to a Jewish man, that's mamzer. If it's a non-Jewish man who has an affair with a Jewish married woman, the child is Jewish and the child is not a mamzer, kind of the best of both. Yeah, the word mamzer means illegitimate child or bastard child is the older term for it. But in Hebrew or in halacha, it's not the same as English. In the English language, a child born out of wedlock is a mamzer, is illegitimate. That's not true in halacha. A child born out of wedlock is perfectly kosher. A mamzer is only a child born out of female adultery or incest. So the term mamzer is narrower than the English term illegitimate. That's important to understand this. A child born out of wedlock has no marital problems. They can marry whoever, he or she can marry whoever they want to marry, usually even a kohen in many cases. Well, yeah, even a Kohen Gadol, because a Kohen Gadol can only marry a virgin, but an out-of-wedlock child could still be... If the out-of-wedlock child grows up and is a virgin, right, she could even marry a Kohen Gadol. Yeah, there's no particular rule for the Kohen Gadol on that either. Okay.
So if the child is born out of wedlock, or if the father is not Jewish...
That's correct. Not a mamzer. That's correct. Although I will say, in that case, she cannot marry a Kohen, meaning to say there's a difference in the two cases. If a non-Jew committed adultery with a Jewish woman, the daughter is not a mamzer, but she cannot marry a Kohen. On the other hand, if it was a simple out-of-wedlock, Jew with Jewish woman out-of-wedlock, the daughter could even marry a Kohen. Either way, they're not a mamzer in both cases. Okay. Now, here is the thing about adoption, though. So because of the problem of mamzer, as a practical solution, parents are often encouraged to adopt a non-Jewish child and convert the child. Convert the baby, I'll discuss that in a moment, because when conversion erases the slate, conversion is a new creation. So whatever happened before, it makes no difference. Conversion is conversion. So again, I want to emphasize, it is a greater mitzvah to adopt a Jewish child than a non-Jewish child, but because of the mamzer problem, parents often prefer to adopt a non-Jewish child and convert them.
When do they convert
them? So here's the thing. You can convert, literally, a newborn baby. A child can be converted at any age, and the way this works is that the parents bring the baby in front of a beis din, which are three rabbis, and the parents have to accept in front of the beis din that they will raise the child in accordance with Torah and mitzvos. And then if the baby is a boy, the baby gets a bris in front of the beis din. And it doesn't even have to be 8 days, although they'll probably wait. The milah of a ger does not have to be 8 days. And then the baby goes into the mikveh. Now, how does a baby go into the mikveh? I throw him into the mikveh? No, we don't do that. But basically, the parent goes into the mikveh. And the parent holds the baby. And the parent, the baby's face is facing the water. It's very important because young babies, until around 6 months, have an automatic swimming reflex that when their face hits water, they hold their breath.
Whoa.
So actually, it's better to take the baby to the mikveh below 6 months than after. After 6 months, he might swallow water. But it's important that he hit the water face first, because the reflex is triggered face first. In fact, it's so cute. I mean, I've officiated at these. No. There's father. Father will go into the mikveh, bathing suit, whatever it is. Father is holding the baby in his arms. The baby is draped over his arms. And the father just, lowers it, holding it, lowers the baby.
And he has to let go at some point?
No, he doesn't have to let go. In other words, he wets his arm ahead of time, so there's water on his arm. And the baby just remains draped over him. He does not let go of the baby at all. And it's just like a quarter of a second. Down, up. And that's it. And it's so cute, because not only the baby not only holds his breath, but the baby even, pumps his legs. He does like that, he swims in the water. Now, when you pull the baby out of the water just a quarter second later, the baby will start crying. Now, people think that's because the baby was scared of the water, it was frightening. No. The baby is crying because it's cold. There's a sudden change in temperature. The mikveh is warm water. In fact, it's the womb environment. It's exactly the way it was 2 weeks ago, back to mom, so he likes it. When you take him out, there's a sudden change, or a girl for the same thing, there's a sudden change in temperature. It's the cold that makes him cry. It's actually not the water. But again, I do want to point out that there are three steps here. All of them are in front of the beis din. Step number one is the parents must commit that they will raise the child with the mitzvahs of the Torah. Stage number two is circumcision, bris milah, for a boy. A girl doesn't have that one. And stage number three is immersion in mikveh. But there's one little thing you need to know. Since this was the conversion of a minor, not an adult, when the kid reaches the age of 13, or in the case of a girl, the age of 12, they have the right to say, "I don't want to be Jewish."
No way.
Yep, they can do it.
Bar
mitzvah. But they only have one day to do it.
Whoa.
And that is the day of their 12th, in the case of a girl, or 13th birthday.
My gosh, that's so intense.
If they don't renounce, they're stuck. Again, I want to point out, people often...
Wait, so they have that one day where they're like,
in limbo?
They're in limbo. It's up
wait,
to them.
So wait, can they convert again?
Wait.
Yes, they can convert
again.
Yeah.
Both for both of them?
Huh?
12 for a girl.
No, 12 for a girl,
well,
13 for a boy. In other words, adulthood.
Still.
Now, here's the thing. I want to clarify this. You will hear people say, that this is a big mistake, people will say, oh, when they become bar mitzvah, they have to convert again. That's not emes. It's the other way around.
See?
They have the right to renounce the conversion.
Do they have to say it in front of
they if they want to renounce it, they have to go in front of a base and then renounce it. They say, I don't want to be Jewish.
Well, that means they're not Jewish?
Can you sat in a
base
when this happened?
No, I don't know of any case when it happens. Baruch Hashem. But I tell parents of adopted children, don't be too mean when your kid's getting ready for bar mitzvah because he might decide to pull a fast one. Day of bar mitzvah, you know, you put down $5,000 for a hall. Kid says, I decided to skip this one, you know. And then
oh,
you're now again. Let me point out: when you renounce a conversion, you're a goy. But if you want to become Jewish later, you just have to reconvert. You can reconvert again, but the old conversion
but
is
lot, like,
null
and void. A lot of families who are conservative, who, like, have bris and have a conversion,
yep.
Conversion, but like, at 8 or 12, if they don't have a, they don't say yes, then they're not Jewish.
No,
that's what I'm saying. You don't have to say yes.
Don't.
It's the other way around.
You
if you don't say no, okay, please understand that. A lot of people say it like you, that's incorrect. They don't have to say yes. They have the right to say no. If they don't say no, that's an automatic yes. Now, Rav Moshe Feinstein has a very fascinating tshuva where he says that if a person didn't know he had that right, let's say you didn't know that's halakha, and you didn't find out till you were 45, the day that you find out, you have that day. In other words, it's the first day of adulthood that you're aware of your option. So it can sometimes be that even if you're all much older than 13.
Can't you just pretend you didn't hear it?
Well, if you want to be Jewish, if you want to be Jewish, in other words, pretend you didn't be able to renounce later. Well, you know, you could do what you want. You can always fool people. But Hashem, you know, that's not going to change your reality. You know, if you can't do it, you can't do it. Even if you think, you know, you can. And the like. Okay? So that's an important thing to do. Now, this is only because you were converted as a child. If an adult converts, right, you understand this. If a grown-up converts, and that means 13 or 12, then they are permanently Jewish. There's no way they can renounce it. You understand this?
Yeah.
The ability to renounce a conversion is only when it was done when the person was a minor, a katan, or a katana. A conversion that was done by an adult is irrevocable.
What if you stop practicing?
In other words, well, this is important. Even if a Jewish person, or a ger for that matter, who became Jewish, converts to Christianity, he is still a Jew. You cannot convert out of Judaism.
I thought that
there's no way you can convert out of Judaism. You could be an idol worshiper, you could be a Buddhist, you could be a Muslim. In the eyes of halacha, you are a Jew. Yeah.
I heard that if the Beis Din finds out that you're not practicing anymore, then they take away your conversion.
Okay, now this is very, 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 very excellent question, and this is a very live controversy in Israel. And she just said that she had heard that if a convert stops keeping Judaism, the Beis Din can revoke his conversion. The press often reports that, but that's not true. What the Beis Din can do is this. If the Beis Din determines that you were not sincere at the time of the conversion, that at the time of the conversion you never meant to keep the commandments, they can then say your conversion was a fraud. But if you were sincere, but you just changed your life a year later, your conversion is irrevocable. Do you see the difference? It's very important. It's very important that you're aware of this difference. The only way a conversion can be annulled is if they determine that you never meant it.
Right, but if you couldn't have converted
yep.
him in the first place. Then.
Well, they shouldn't have converted him, but sometimes they get fooled. Sometimes a person makes promises, and then when they leave the Beis Din, they go out and have a ham sandwich, you know, that type of thing. So it's very important that you need to differentiate between a ger who stops keeping commandments, in which case he's still Jewish, versus a ger when we see he never intended to keep the commandments, in which case a Beis Din can annul the conversion. So what's happening in Israel is that a lot, and this is very controversial, some Batei Dinim are invalidating thousands of conversions, even the people who already have grandchildren, on the grounds that they were not religious to begin with, and that's a controversial thing.
Yeah.
But that is not the same as annulling a conversion because somebody stopped being religious later. Yeah.
When you convert a baby,
yep.
Do you have to worry about which conservative Orthodox you convert them to?
You sure do. The same way that a conservative or reformed conversion is not valid for an adult, a conservative and reformed conversion is not valid for a baby. So you need the same halachic standards for infant or child conversions. It doesn't have to be an infant. You can convert a five-year-old also, as you would for this. Now, the good thing about this is, if I could use a computer analogy, you can always upgrade conversions. Meaning to say, if a person had a conservative or reformed conversion, that doesn't bar the door from entering the Jewish people. The person could have an Orthodox conversion later. In fact, the way it works in Israel, even people that have Orthodox conversions have to keep on getting higher Orthodox conversions because the Rabbanut in Israel often does not recognize American conversions.
Oh, really?
You know,
is it faster for them?
Oh, faster for where?
Is it faster to...
It might be. In other words, for example, I mean, I'll tell you my own experience. I used to be in the conversion business a little bit. That is, if you have a conservative convert, let's say, who studied for 5 years, who knows Hebrew, who knows the Chumash, even if they weren't so observant, and now they're ready to be observant, we can move much faster, because even though their background was conservative, they might have a lot of basic Torah knowledge. So you could move faster. Yeah, absolutely. There's no reason to treat somebody who knows how to read Hebrew and translate the Chumash the same way as somebody who's starting from absolutely zero. So that could be of some advantage and the like. On the other hand, some argue that sometimes it would have to take longer because they absorbed all sorts of false ideas that we got to get rid of, right? So some have argued, I'd rather have somebody who knows nothing than somebody who knows a lot of things that are not authentically Jewish. So it all depends. It all depends on the case. You can't really give a general rule for that. Okay? All right. Yeah. Yeah, sure.
You said that if a person that was converted when they were little and they were never aware that they had to choose.
Yes.
Let's say they're 40 years old. Now they have the option to just say, I'm not Jewish.
Yes, but just for 24 hours, just for one day.
Does that mean that they were never fully Jewish in the first place? Because if they were, then it's weird that they could, just stop.
Your point is very well taken. When you declare that you don't want to be Jewish, you're not saying, I was Jewish until now, and I'm dropping it. You're actually saying, my conversion was not valid all the way back from the beginning. This is why I use the word annul. Annul in English means retroactively. The conversion was null and void.
That if he accepts, when he becomes aware, he says,
yes.
Hey, I want to continue being Jewish, that also means that he's only Jewish from that point.
No, the other way around. He went through a conversion. If he doesn't annul that conversion, he remains Jewish from that point. Meaning, not from the point of his agreement. He remains Jewish from the point of the actual conversion, going all the way back to when he was five.
It's
and the
weird,
like.
Though, that, at that point, his soul just moves
him. Metaphysically and Kabbalistically, when you talk about, this is a difficult concept, you're 100% correct, because we talk about a ger getting a new soul. Actually, it's machlokas. How do you conceptualize conversion? There are two different views in Kabbalah. Do you say that anyone who converts to Judaism had a Jewish neshama that they were born with, and that's what brought them to Judaism? Or do you say that the final act of immersion in the mikveh gives them a new neshama? There's a machlokas. Do we say he always had the Jewish neshama, or is there a new? Many people who convert, I don't know if there are gerim here, they often describe the process, I felt I was Jewish. Even if they grew up in Montana or a place that had no Jews. I know someone is from Montana here, right? So I apologize. I always use that as my analogy, but I shouldn't. Maybe I should pick some other place, Fiji Islands or something. But there are people who, you know, the closest Jew was 1,000 miles away, and there wasn't even a Chabad house, right? Where Antarctica or whatever. There's no Chabad of Antarctica, right?
Not yet.
Okay, but they're born, right? Yeah, that's a good shlichus. You know, everyone likes the cold weather. But the thing is, they say, there was no Jew within 1,000 miles, but they say, I always felt I was Jewish. Many Gerim will describe it that way. So that kind of implies that they were born with that Jewish neshama. On the other hand, you're right. If they can annul the conversion, like what happens? But again, we would have to say, if they annul the conversion, like Hashem knows the future, that means they never had the Jewish neshama. Okay? Because Hashem knows ahead of time what they're going to do, so that's kind of how it's fixed. Yeah.
I just don't get the part of like how you're saying if a newborn was converted,
yep.
Right?
Yep.
Days after their birth.
Yep.
They're Jewish.
That's correct.
Right. So then you're saying when they're bar mitzvah,
yep.
They have the option
yep.
to decide if they want to continue being Jewish or not.
That's right.
And if they say that they don't want to continue being Jewish,
yep.
Does that mean that the everything the whole 13 years of their life they were
That is what they were a guy. That's right.
It's like when the Beis Din
determines
right. that it was
that's right.
never.
It goes retroactively. That's what we mean by retroactively. Now, that's one issue, the conversion issue. Now, a second issue was an issue that the Rebbe raised many, many years ago. And again, almost all the other poskim followed the Rebbe. They agreed with him on this. And as the Rebbe pointed out, and this is a hardship, this might be a shtickle hardship for people. And that is, we know that there are all sorts of restrictions on men-women interactions. Among them are yichud. What does yichud mean? A man is not allowed to be alone with a woman in a secluded area because improper physical contact might take place. And there's also prohibitions of hugging and kissing. Negiah, right? Now, those prohibitions do not apply, obviously, to parents and children. Mothers can hug sons, fathers can kiss daughters, no problem. But the Rebbe's argument was this. The Rebbe's argument is that since how biologically a father and an adopted daughter are not related, so the Rebbe said that a father and an adopted daughter, now that doesn't mean when she's a baby, because these prohibitions only kick in at a certain age. I'll discuss the age. But at the age in which these prohibitions kick in, the Rebbe said, and obviously this is a psak that Chabad follows, but the truth is, even most non-Chabad poskim say the same thing, that there is an isser of yichud.
It's in the Kitzur Shulchan.
Yeah, okay. There's an isser of yichud between the father and the adopted daughter, and as well as hugging and kissing. And the same thing would be between the mother and the adopted child.
That's a little ridiculous, because there's no way that a father who cared for the child their whole life can develop
a sense
of relief.
Well, I don't know. Well, Woody Allen married his stepdaughter. Okay, whatever.
So,
you don't know. Okay, but anyway, but you're right. You're right. But the Rebbe basically said that the rule of Chazal depends very much on biological relationship. Now, this does mean that, now again, I point out the isser of yichud and negiah doesn't kick into a baby. I mean, I could kiss a baby, you know, anybody's baby. But so generally speaking, you know, the isser of hugging and kissing applies only when there's the temptation of sexuality. So it depends on what age it kicks in. Typically, for example, well, different posts will be strict, but typically we could say that one is allowed, say a man is allowed to have physical contact with a woman before the age that she would be expected to have her period, which might be anywhere from 10, 11.
I thought it was
3.
Yeah, it's longer.
So some people are machmer at 3, but many people are makel earlier, and the like. But all the Rebbe is saying is that at whatever point there's an isser of yichud, and Nagia, that would kick in with adopted children. Now, there's a book, I'm not sure if it's in the library here, but this is one of the bestsellers. It was called The Bamboo Cradle. Do you have Bamboo Cradle? So, interesting book. Bamboo Cradle is about a couple who were not religious at the time, and he was like a professor of anthropology in China, an American, but he was in China, and they found an abandoned baby in a train station. A little girl, a little baby girl in the trade, the Bamboo Cradle. It's a novel. It's not a novel. It's a book. Yeah. So what happened was they adopted her and they raised her and then they became Orthodox. They became frum and she became frum.
It's not true.
Yeah, it's all true. It's all true. And he mentions at the time that when his daughter was around 14, the great rabbi Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach said that you're not allowed to hug her or kiss her anymore. Because she reached a certain age. And he talked about how hard that was for him to initially accept, but he then understood, you know, that this was the halacha. So most poskim do follow the Rebbe, and I assume as good Chabad people, you will follow that. I do want to tell you that there is a minority opinion that goes the other way, and the minority opinion is the opinion of Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, who was the head of the Yerushalayim Beis Din. He died only around maybe 3 or 4 years ago. And he basically made your argument. And he said that that the reason why the Chachamim permit yichud, seclusion, and negia of children and parents is not because of biological connection, but it's because in a normally healthy, sane person, the one that you raised as a baby, you're not going to have sexual urges and attractions. So he said it does not depend on biology. It depends on the fact that you raise them from infancy. So the Tzitz Eliezer therefore rules that any child that was adopted as a baby under one year, there will never be an Isser of Yichud or Negia. Now, even Rav Oldenburg, however, would say if you adopted the child a little bit older, certainly if you adopted a five-year-old, the Yisurim will kick in. This is only a heter for infancy adoptions and the like. Lamaisa, I tended to be lenient because I thought that adopted children in particular needed the physical affection. So I followed, in my own rabbinate, I followed Rav Waldenberg's psak, but it is a minority view. The majority view is what the Rebbe said, that the laws of Yichud and Negia do kick in, and that makes no difference if the child is a goy that was converted or a Jew. These halachos don't depend on that particular status.
Wouldn't this sort of like make adoption less desirable in the Jewish community?
It might. You know, depending. You know, it might. Listen, but the truth of the matter is, you know, but some modern Orthodox in particular don't follow the laws of Yichud and Negiah anyway, so they're not going to follow
right.
it. But yeah, you're correct. For some people,
seems
this might
really
be a factor.
Harsh.
It is difficult, especially when there are other children. Meaning to say, the thing that's very difficult is when there are other children in the house who are natural children,
oh, yeah.
and they get hugged and kissed,
exactly, really
and the other child doesn't, then you get into a very, very painful. It's one thing if, you know, he's the only child, all right, so parents aren't big huggers, right? Some parents don't, like, hug their kids anyway that much. But when you have differentials, it's very, very painful, and that's why I think Rav Waldenberg's psak needs to be followed sometimes. I'll give you another example of difficulty. You know, this is also very important. Adoption does not confer Kohen or Levi status. This is very important. If a Kohen adopts a child, that child is not a Kohen. He's either a regular Yisrael or a Ger, if he was converted. Now, I know a family where the father is a Kohen, and they adopt a child, and they have natural sons. So the natural sons are Kohanim, and the adopted child is not a Kohen. Now, in Yerushalayim, I don't know if you know this, because I don't know if you go to shul during the week, but Yerushalayim is different, or actually, Eretz Yisrael is different than Chutz La'aretz. In Chutz La'aretz, the Kohanim duchen, they bless the people only on Yom Tov. But in Yerushalayim, and in most of Eretz Yisrael, the Kohanim bless the congregation every single day. Are you aware of this? That the Kohanim say, Yivarechecha, the priestly blessing, is recited every day. So imagine this. father goes with his children to shul. Let's say there are five children, right? So four of them are natural born and one is adopted. Four of the kids go up with their father to duchen, and the one child doesn't.
Ooh.
Very, one can imagine. So as a result, what I understand is that the adopted child doesn't like to daven in the same shul with his father because he feels excluded. So these are, you know, what can I say? These are hardships. In other words, in the halakhic system, there are sometimes going to be cases that are hard, and the way we have to deal with it is to compensate in the areas that we're able to compensate. Show the child extra love in all sorts of other ways. You have to, sometimes Hashem's system, you know, we don't fully understand, and we have to accept it as the truth, but we then try to fix things. Yeah.
I think that biologically, even if your father isn't biologically Jewish, he's not halachically your father.
That's also true. That's
so
correct.
To the same rules of Yechidus and...
That's a fascinating question because that is the flip side, right? In other words, in the case of adoption, you have the emotional bonds without the biological bonds. In the case of conversion, you have the biological bond, right? But halachically, it got erased, right? So the
not
question...
Not even conversion, though, like if you're...
Yeah. Or not conversion, but I mean a non-Jewish parent. That's right. It wasn't conversion. Yeah. We are lenient, although some people are much more... Okay. So this is my low-tech option, adoption. But of course, the low-tech option doesn't mean it's cheap. Adoption is quite expensive, actually. And adoption could easily cost... $20,000-$30,000 in terms of all of that. So it is expensive, especially if you are looking for a healthy child. Some parents are willing and they actually want what is called a special needs child, whether it be severely retarded or the like, and that requires a very, very special type of family that's able to do it. And those children are much easier to adopt. In other words, it's much easier to find them because there are fewer people that are wanting to adopt them. But if you want a healthy white child, it can cost quite a lot of money in order to find such a child. Okay, now let's move away from adoption and talk briefly about ART, assisted reproductive technology. Are you going to be here next week too?
Yeah.
Okay, so I'll probably have to continue next week, but I'll at least begin it now. Yeah.
Can I ask you one good question?
Yeah.
What if a couple adopt a child and they think he's not Jewish, but he is, and they put him through the conversion process? Does it matter that he was?
No. In other words, the worst that it happens is it's superfluous. Meaning, if you take a Jew,
right, that's what I'm trying to
if
say.
You take a so Jew that, and convert him to Judaism,
reneges on it.
Well, he can't renege because he's Jewish.
Yeah, but how would you know? Well,
this might happen. Listen, this might happen. Let me just mention, in America, you can assume, if you don't know if a child is Jewish or not Jewish, halacha always assumes that anyone that is separated from a larger group is from the majority part of the group. And since most people in the United States are not Jewish, the halacha says, in cases of doubt, you assume he's not Jewish. And therefore, you are permitted to follow all of the consequences of not being Jewish. In Eretz Israel...
Jewish in Israel?
Israel is the only country. That's correct. Israel is the only country in which the majority is Jewish. And even that, we're not... you know, we're not such a great majority either. We have a very large Arab group.
But
you
live in, like, Brooklyn.
Well...
Not
but the question is... In other words, the question becomes, I understand, but where did you get the child? Meaning, if you found the child in the middle of Borough Park, then you might have to assume he's Jewish. But if you got him from an adopting agency, the fact that you're living in Brooklyn does make a difference. The child could have been gotten from anywhere in the world.
You said that if you adopt a child in Israel, you assume that he's Jewish?
Unless you know to the contrary, since the majority of people in Israel are Jewish, so... You always have to assume the unknown is the majority, is from the majority. That's an important halakha. That's called rov. Rov means all doubtful cases are deemed to come from the majority component of things. Okay. So now let's talk a little bit about advanced technology. And I'm going to start with the oldest advanced technology, which is really It's pretty old. I mean, we had it even in the 19th century. That is artificial insemination. Artificial insemination simply means that sperm is accumulated and it is injected into the woman's body via a syringe. Artificial insemination was developed actually in animal breeding because basically it was considered dangerous to have bulls mate with cows because all sorts of things could happen, so they would inject cows with bull semen and the like. Now, artificial insemination can occur in two different varieties. There is what is called AID. AID means artificial insemination from a sperm donor, not the woman's husband. And then there is AIH, which is artificial insemination from the husband. So let's take each of them. Artificial insemination from the husband obviously will have less problems, but there are some issues there as well. One issue is, you may ask the question, well, what's the purpose of artificial insemination from the husband? Let them just have relations.
Yeah.
Well, sometimes you have a situation where if there is either a low sperm count and the like, so you may want to collect several ejaculates, more than would come out in an intercourse, and that would enhance the possibilities of pregnancy. So that's AIH. So the main halachic problem of AIH is how is the sperm obtained? We know that there are laws against emission of sperm in vain, etc. How do you obtain that sperm? I don't want to go into graphic detail of all of these things. This is a family shear, so to speak. But let me just say that the basic idea of the poskim is that since the purpose of this emission is to enhance fertility and procreation, so even though it is not in the context of intercourse, we do not treat it as wasting seed because it is being done for a procreative purpose. Again, one obviously needs to be in very close consultation with a posek as to how this is done, because sometimes what happens is that hospitals and doctors want to have test after test after test. They want more samples just for analysis. And if they're just testing and doing this and that, the man has to say no. The man says, I will give sperm to be used, not just to be tested and analyzed over and over and over again. But one has to be extremely careful that the sperm not be switched. And unfortunately, we do have some scandals, not Baruch Hashem, not in Israel, that I'm aware of, in which fertility clinics have sometimes switched sperm. Sometimes they do it by accident. Sometimes they do it on purpose. There was a doctor in Virginia who happened to be a Jewish doctor who had an extraordinarily high rate of success with his patients. You know, amazing. Like everyone only had like a 30% rate. He had an 85% rate of his female patients getting pregnant. And he was using artificial insemination and IVF. And it was determined that he was just using his own sperm for everything. That he was, you had like 100 women came. And husbands gave 100 samples. And he just threw it all out and did his own. And apparently he was...
Didn't he care that he had all these children?
Well, the idea was they would never find out. Now, eventually it was found out. He lost his license, etc. But here is the thing. It was predicted that if this would not have been found out, the probabilities of incest, of a brother marrying a sister based on demographic patterns, was something like 25% chance that a brother would marry a sister, because people tend to get married within a 25-mile radius, and you have like these hundreds of brothers and sisters who don't even know they're related, and it's very likely there'd be some shiduchim between them. So you need to be sure...
He was religious?
Oh, no, Chas v'Shalom, no, he was not religious, I'm not using him as a religious example. All I'm saying is that when you're involved in any fertility treatment of AIH, or IVF for that matter, just AIH is in the woman's body, IVF is in the test tube, but it's the same issue, you got to be absolutely sure that the sperm doesn't get switched, but Baruch Hashem,
Do you watch it the whole thing?
Why would they do it otherwise, did you say?
Well, sometimes they just mess up. They mislabel things. If you've ever worked in a medical lab, he did it on purpose. He did it on purpose. Maybe he was crazy. Maybe he was sick. I don't know exactly. Maybe he knew. He knew that he was a lot more fertile than most of those men that he was testing. So he figured he'll get a good success rate by using his own. It's crazy. It's crazy and it's rare, but it can happen, and one has to be very, very careful about that. Yeah.
In that case, would the children be
non-parent? Let me put it this way. That's really. I'll get to it in a second. That's an excellent question. Now, yeah, that'll really be AID because essentially he took what should have been AIH and he made it AID. So your question is exactly the question of donor sperm. Yeah.
I have a very controversial question.
Yes.
May you please pause the recording because it's a true story.
Okay. Let me explain something here. Everyone knows, of course, that Jewish identity is based on mother, not father. And technically, even if a father is Jewish, the kid is not Jewish. If the mother's not Jewish, yeah, that's correct. But there is a concept that children with a Jewish father are still somehow connected to the Jewish nation. So we sometimes are easier in trying to convert them, meaning we're more proactive in converting them. But the way we would have to analyze it is this. Every egg is different. The egg that was fertilized from the Jewish man has a Jewish father. The egg that was fertilized from the non-Jewish man does not have a Jewish father. There's no package deal here. Every single twin is going to be analyzed separately. And one has a Jewish father, and therefore we might be more proactive in a conversion, although he's a goy because the mother is not Jewish, and the other doesn't have a Jewish father, right? So when you really think about this, it's not such a complicated situation. It's an unusual situation, but it's not such a complicated situation. I thought you were raising a scenario where sperm from two people fertilized a single egg. That is, there are some science fiction possibilities, but that's generally considered scientifically impossible as far as we know.
If identical twins can be an egg fertilized twice, then why couldn't it be from two different people?
The egg fertilized twice or the egg splitting? The egg fertilized once and then splitting. I think it's fertilized once.
Right.
There's only a single fertilization that then splits. An egg cannot be fertilized twice. I'm just going to begin the next one. Artificial insemination with the donor, because that ties into your question. And here we have one of the most famous, interesting machloksim in halacha. That is, let's say the man can't produce sperm at all. The man is totally infertile. The woman desires to have a child. Can a married woman be impregnated via sperm donor?
Won't the child be a
mamzer? So here we get into the machlokas. The big machlokas here is between actually someone who's both people are very, very famous. One is the Satmar Rebbe. Have you heard of the Rebbe of Satmar? Now, the Satmar Rebbe is known, or was known, actually, there is still a Satmar Rebbe, but this is the original Satmar Rebbe, who died in the 1970s. The original Satmar Rebbe was known for his very strong anti-Zionist views, and that goes back, we talked about that last week, Yom HaTzmaut, but this has nothing to do with Zionism. The Satmar Rebbe took the logical position, right? So you're a Satmar, right? You say exactly the Satmar Rebbe. The Satmar Rebbe took the position that if a married Jewish woman is impregnated with sperm from a man other than her husband, she is committing adultery. And because she is committing adultery, the child is a mamzer.
So
if the father is not Jewish, it would not be a mamzer, that's correct. But the child would have that spirit. Well, he wouldn't be a mamzer, but he also wouldn't be a child of the Jewish man either. So there'd be very little point. And not only that, the Satmar Rebbe said, but do you know if a woman commits adultery? I don't mean rape, God forbid. I mean adultery, voluntary adultery. She's not allowed to stay married to her husband. So the Satmar Rebbe said, if a Jewish married woman undergoes insemination with donor sperm, the child is a mamzer, and she is not allowed to stay married to her husband because she's an adulteress. This was the Satmar Rebbe's position. Rav Moshe Feinstein, you know, the great decisor of halacha in the 20th century, Rav Moshe Feinstein strenuously disagreed with the Satmar Rebbe because he took the position that adultery does not exist via syringe. Adultery requires sexual intercourse, and in the absence of sexual intercourse, mere impregnation does not produce adultery, nor does it produce mamzer. And Rav Moshe wrote this in four different responsa over a 10-year period. And what's interesting is that the Satmars were so incensed with it that Rav Moshe was burnt in effigy. Different things. It was a very, very difficult time. You know, this was a very controversial psak. But Rav Moshe said the following. Rav Moshe said, however, that AID should be discouraged for another reason. Not because of adultery or mamzer. But he said AID produces secret siblings. Right, exactly the problem I mentioned with Dr. Jacobson. And that is, you might have a situation where a brother marries a sister because sperm donors tend to repeat, right? They're repeat contributors. And there may be a lot of boys and girls from that same anonymous sperm donor. So Rabbi Feinstein was concerned with incest, but he then came up with the following idea. He said that if the sperm donor is a non-Jew, halachically, not biologically, but halachically, you avoid the incest problem, because since when a non-Jew impregnates a Jewish woman, he's not considered the father, so the child that's born from that non-Jew sperm is not related to any of the other kids. So Rav Feinstein therefore said the following. A woman should not do AID, but if she does AID, she should be sure it's from a non-Jewish sperm donor rather than a Jewish sperm donor, because with a Jewish sperm donor, there is a problem of secret incest. With a non-Jewish sperm donor, there is no problem of secret incest. Now, Hasidim went crazy over this because they basically said Rabbi Feinstein was encouraging women to get impregnated from non-Jewish sperm. I mean, that sounds spiritually a very, very awful, awful thing. But that's how Rabbi Feinstein actually came out. Many poskim in Eretz Yisrael are very, very strict on this. Many poskim in Eretz Yisrael, number one, say if it's Jewish sperm, there is mamzer, and non-Jewish sperm is as if she's sleeping with a non-Jew. You know, it's taking that analogy further. Now, I'll go back over this. I just want to mention one final question. Tonight we spoke on very, very quickly. I hope this is addressing what you wanted to hear about. We spoke very quickly about husband sperm, and we spoke about donor sperm for a married woman. What about a single woman? This is an issue that people face today. You know, there is a biological clock, and we have religious women, who are approaching, let's say they're 45 or 46 or whatever it is, and they feel that their childbearing years are declining, and they haven't found a shidduch, and they very much want to have a child. And they don't want to have an affair with somebody out of wedlock or whatever it is. That's not proper. They don't want to have intercourse with somebody. That's their religious person. But what about going to a sperm bank, anonymous sperm donor, and, getting pregnant that way? What would halacha say about a single woman? Now, there's no adultery issue here. She's not married.
Except for by the Satmar opinion.
No, but that's not true. The Satmar opinion is only if the woman is married.
Oh.
Here we're talking about a single woman.
Okay.
Right? So this is an issue. Religious women have begun to ask this question. And these are sincere women. These are not, about utilization of a sperm bank in order to have a child. There's no adultery here because she's not married. So here, as you would expect, the halachic consensus has not been so supportive of it. And the basic concept is that we do not want to encourage reproduction outside of marriage for the following reason. There are actually two reasons. Reason number one is that in terms of the holiness of a Jewish home, we always talk about, the Gemara talks about, three partners in a human being: father, mother, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And optimally, a Jewish home should have a father and a mother. Now, granted, the reality is there are divorces. The reality is there's widowhood. I mean, granted, not every home is an intact home of father and mother, and even when there is father and mother, it's not always a happy home, etc. But those are things that happen. But to deliberately bring a baby into an environment where there will not be a father is considered to be improper, because Hashem wants children to be raised in the context of a father and a mother. That's one reason. The second reason is that by giving reproductive options that don't require marriage, you are removing at least some of the incentives to get married. Meaning, clearly the Torah wants people to get married. And one of the reasons that push people to get married is a desire to have kids. But now that you're creating a framework where you can have kids without getting married, so chas v'shalom, that may have some effect on encouraging people to get married. So the point I'm making is this. This is a strange halacha. You can't really say that it's forbidden. You can't really say that it's osur. In other words, you can't point to a concrete violation of halacha for a single woman to be impregnated in this way. Unlike a married woman where we could point to adultery and the like. But it's a type of thing where, although it may not violate the letter of Jewish law, it can violate the overall spirit of Jewish law. How does Hashem want children to be raised? What type of families does HaKadosh Baruch Hu want us to have? And that's very important. Sometimes you have to look not just at the literal application of halacha, you have to look at the values of how HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants us to live, and this would not be an option. But I will tell you, there is at least one posek, Rav Sherlo, who's a Dati Liumi posek, and Rav Sherlo actually did allow single women to get impregnated by sperm donors, but he had a lot of conditions. She had to be at least 40 years old, and she had to be engaged in an attempt to find a shidduch for at least 10 years. She had to really make a real effort to try to get married, and only when all things fail, you know, then he said there would be such a leniency that one might get. Now again, please, especially tonight, I am not giving you anything for practical implementation. This is just to understand the theoretical structure of things. And next time we'll finish this off, we'll talk about IVF and surrogacy, gestational surrogacy and cloning as well. So we'll talk about